You're listening to the Kazakalam Project on Kazakalam Media. This is your host, Che Tingye. For anyone interested in Taiwan, China is the big fat dragon in the room. We caught up with China commentator Gordon Chang after the protests in Hong Kong 2 weeks ago. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy students and activists are upset that Beijing severely limited their right to vote for the chief executive in 2017 by only allowing candidates handpicked by China. But China's problems are not limited to Hong Kong. In Taiwan, we have witnessed an outpour of anti-China sentiment along with the Sunflower Movement when students occupied Taiwan's legislature to protest a trade agreement with China. From Japan to Southeast Asia to Australia and to India, seems like everyone is forced to react to more aggressive Chinese policies. And within China, it has an almost unending list of issues, from rule of law, politics, to economic and environmental problems, just simmering under the lid. Gordon has written a book called A Coming Collapse of China all the way back in 2001, and he currently writes for Forbes, World Affairs Journal, and other foreign policy publications. We ask him about geopolitics in Asia, what advice he would give to the next US and Taiwan presidents, and how he responds to criticism that he is a China alarmist. Here's our interview. Gordon, thanks for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
First of all, we wanted to talk about what happened last night, which is there's a protest in Hong Kong over the decision of Beijing basically not allowing free and universal elections of the head executive in Hong Kong. So I just wanted to sort of get your first reaction on that. And the question I would like to know is, do you see Beijing sort of saying, well, there's a sentiment in Hong Kong that's more and more defiant? Do you see Beijing cracking down on that more, or do you see Beijing making some sort of compromise in the near future?
I think it was clear from June of this year that Beijing is going to be intransigent. That's when it issued its white paper on Hong Kong's electoral process and democracy and liberalization, and they shut the door in June. And clearly, with the decision of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress today, it's clear that they are not going to give an inch. It's going to be up to the Hong Kong people to go into the streets and to tell Beijing that they want more say in their lives. And only if they do that do they have a chance of Beijing to the side. This is going to be very, very difficult because now there's very little room for compromise. Beijing has very clear words on this, and it's put the prestige of the Communist Party on line. And I think the party actually believes that this is an existential struggle, because if you allow political liberalization in Hong Kong, free and fair elections, then you've got to allow it in Macau as well. And then it's very difficult for Beijing to say to people in the mainland, no, you can't have what people in Hong Kong have. So for the Communist Party, this is where it all comes down to.
So on the one hand, you say sort of there's no room for compromise, yet what can the people in Hong Kong do? I mean, should they escalate the protests? Should they escalate their demands? Or how does that clash? Do you see an ending to that clash that does not involve some sort of violence or some sort of escalation?
Well, clearly there's been violence in Hong Kong up to now, but it's been violence by Beijing's loyalists. So, for instance, the attack on the former Ming Pao editor, and also the ramming of the home of Jimmy Lai, Next Media. These are from China. I mean, the people in Hong Kong are orderly when they take to the streets. And so, you know, we may see massive civil disobedience, but it will be peaceful civil disobedience. I actually think that the people of Hong Kong have got to make their protests known. They've got to show their numbers, because that's the only way Beijing will ever move aside. I think that it's going to be very difficult for China to do that because of what I mentioned, that they see this as an existential struggle, that this is where the party's authority is on the line. But nonetheless, people in Hong Kong have a right to have say in their lives. And so I think that this is something they have to do, even if they know beforehand, as they do, that Hong Kong, that Beijing is going to be very, very difficult and intransigent.
I see. So just wanted to sort of zoom out a little bit. Looking at the sort of East Asian region as a whole, you've been saying that China's aggressiveness is destabilizing the region, and there might be this sort of maritime Asia alliance formed against China between Japan and India and the countries of Southeast Asia in between. We've seen Japan taking this very seriously with Article 9 reinterpretation, etc. But how do you see other nations such as India or even ASEAN countries, which rely on China for trade? So how do you see them play out?
Well, right now we have India's new prime minister, Narendra Modi, is in Japan for a five-day visit. And primarily they're talking about security. They're setting up security mechanisms, a 2+2 mechanism of the foreign minister and the defense ministers talking to each other. There are going to be all sorts of cooperation that we haven't seen in the past. And this is important because, you know, about 10 years ago, Taro Aso, when he was Japan's foreign minister, talked about an arc of freedom and prosperity. Well, at one end of that arc is Japan, and at the other is India. And I think what we're going to see is countries in the middle fill in because they are like-minded. They're all threatened by China. And clearly, we are starting to see this form. Now, it's going to take some time. There are a lot of countries that are still very concerned, pushing them together by their hostile and belligerent acts from Beijing. So this is something that I think is going to be evident, especially as we head into the end of this year and next year. We are going to see the countries in the region work more closely together because they realize they have no choice but to do so. And it's because of Beijing. It's giving them no choice.
And so looking at this arc from Japan to Southeast Asia to India, where does the U.S. fit into all this? I mean, there's a lot of attention still on the Middle East.
The U.S. is important because...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the U.S. is important because the U.S. has alliances in the region. Japan, South Korea, Thailand, and also Australia. Also, we're very good friends with Taiwan and India and Singapore. So clearly the United States has a role. The one thing that's important about the U.S. position is that we have, for more than two centuries, if we've had any consistent foreign policy, it has been the defense of freedom of navigation. And threatening that by trying to close off those freedoms, and not only in the South China Sea, which it considers to be an internal Chinese lake, but also in the East China Sea. And I'm sure that as China becomes more powerful, it is going to try to do the same thing in the Indian Ocean. So the U.S. is working with its partners and its friends in the region, and that includes almost everybody. And that even includes former foes like Vietnam, which, of course, are threatened by China's territorial ambitions. So this is going to be a region looking to the United States. Now, of course, as you point out, the United States is distracted. It's got a problem in Syria and Iraq, now in Ukraine. But we don't get to choose where we deal with our adversaries. We are at one of those points in history where we may have to do everything at the same time. You know, it's unfortunate. But there are those moments, you know, and we saw those in the 1930s and 1940s, where the U.S. had to be involved all over the world.
So, and in light of current trends, how should Taiwan play its cards? In other words, what advice would you give to whoever is taking power in 2016 in Taiwan?
The overriding reality is that, most people in Taiwan want to be left alone. They don't want to be part of the People's Republic of China. You know, they see themselves as Taiwanese. They want their own society. Taiwan is a very successful society. And so whoever takes over in 2016 as president is going to have to respond to those aspirations. And this is important. You know, China is making itself a rogue state, and to ally itself with China would be absolutely the wrong thing. Also, China has an economy which right now is in distress. So why would you tie yourself to history's next great disaster? For Taiwan, the future is going to be in its own society and to building friendships around the region and around the world. That has proven successful for Taiwan in the past, and that's what's going to be successful for Taiwan in the future. Yes, you can have good relations with China, but that does not mean you shouldn't have good relations with other nations, and especially good economic ties, because as we have been seeing, there's a lot of problems in the Chinese economy right now. It's growing very slowly, if it's growing at all. You've got a debt crisis coming. You've got a property bubble that's bound to burst. And tying your economy to China's right now is absolutely the wrong strategy.
You mentioned China's economy. I mean, I think you've mentioned before that the reason why China's economy looks so good on paper and, you know, with these steady growth is because China's government can put problems away or so cover things up before things get out of hand. Now, you said that that just causes all the problems, latent problems, to sort of build up. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And also, especially China's its biggest import and export partner, you know, how should Taiwan sort of roll that back? Or how should Taiwan play its cards in the economic realm?
Taiwanese manufacturers go to China because they want cheap labor, because they want easy access to all sorts of services and land and all the rest of it. But China is now much less of a favorable destination for manufacturers because you have continually wage increases in excess of productivity. You see leaving the areas where Taiwan has really been successful, and they're either moving inland into China or, more significantly, they're moving to other countries like Bangladesh, Vietnam, even places outside of the region. So Taiwan's manufacturers are going to have to follow them. They went to China not for political reasons, but for economic reasons, and they will leave China not for political reasons, but for economic ones as well. We are going to see manufacturing scatter around the world because that is what is economically necessary for them to do. I think that it's very important on the part of the Taiwan government to encourage manufacturers to diversify, because putting all your eggs in one basket, even a great basket, is never a good strategy. And especially for one like China right now, where you do have all of these problems, not just in the economy, but also in the political system, where you see the severe infighting at the top of the Communist Party, you see the paralysis in the government because of the moves that Xi Jinping is making against his political opponents. You see all of these problems occurring. And it's not just the problems of today, it's long-term problems. You've got demographic decline, you've got an environment which is really in stress. None of these things are good for foreign investment. So we have got, I think, a moment for Taiwan's leadership to diversify and help Taiwan manufacturers go around the world. That's what's economically necessary. And I think that's what is also good politically for Taiwan.
I see. Sort of coming back to the Hong Kong protests, sort of talking about, sort of thinking about it in the same strand of the Sunflower Movement in Taiwan back in March and April, seems that there's especially this outburst of anti-China political energy, especially from the young people, both in Hong Kong and in Taiwan. We know that in Hong Kong, there's not much of an outlet politically for these young people. But how should that energy be channeled in Taiwan, in your opinion?
Well, I think the Sunflower Movement is doing certain things which are really good right now. So, for instance, you see people involved going around the world explaining what they did. And that's important because I think people around the world need to understand that people in Taiwan are not necessarily view themselves as Chinese, that people in Taiwan see themselves as distinct and separate and apart from the People's Republic. And that's a message that people need to hear around the world. And that's what the Sunflower students are doing. Also, they need to explain the politics right now in Taiwan about the problems with the Kuomintang government. And it's important that they hear that, people around the world hear that from people in Taiwan. So I think that that's a really very important initiative. And of course, you know, when Sunflower students remain politically involved, because we have a very important election, and in 2016, we've got elections this year as well. And this is not to endorse any one political party, but it's to push both parties in better directions. And this is very important because you have a what many people say to be a critical period coming up, especially with problems in China. And they very well may decide to take out their problems by dealing with Taiwan and Hong Kong and Macau and other places in a very harsh manner. So it's important for Taiwan to defend its own society right now at what could be a very crucial period in time.
And just from what I've seen, people sort of on the other side talking about these students, you know, there's people who are saying, well, you know, these students are very idealistic, that's great, but then they are not being pragmatic, they're not being realistic. They are pushing the politicians, or they're pushing the leadership towards a more dangerously radical position. How would you respond to that sort of criticism?
First, never know what is possible until you try to do it. Whatever you do is what's possible. You know, and we have seen so many impossible movements succeed, you know, starting in 1989. You know, I grew up, I thought I was going to see the Soviet Union live on the day that I died. I could not conceive of the Soviet Union falling apart. Even after the events of 1989 in Eastern Europe, many people saw the Soviet Union as staying there forever. So, you know, there are all sorts of movements that are occurring. And it's not in 1989 and 1991. Of course, we saw the same in Arab societies. Just a few years ago, we saw all the color revolutions around the world. And so it's very important for people to understand that the impossible almost becomes the inevitable, as Trotsky once said. And he was absolutely right, at least about that. I don't see this as being radical at all. I mean, when you want to stand up for your own society, when you want freedom and democracy, those are not radical concepts. These are things that we should all be fighting for, even in societies like the US. So you need to do this day in and day out, because as Ronald Reagan said, you know, freedom and democracy are only one generation away from extinction. So it's very important for us to keep on fighting for these things, even in societies where we take them for granted, as we do in the one that I am in right now. And it's certainly important for people in Taiwan to do it, which is certainly more endangered. It's endangered not only from certain elements in Taiwan society, but also, of course, from that rather big and ugly country across the Taiwan Strait.
Sort of listening to reading a lot of your pieces and listening to a lot of your interviews, some people sort of on the other side may call you a China alarmist, standing sort of opposite to people who are maybe considered China apologists. Like I think Eric Lee, who writes a lot of these articles about how China's system of government is better than democracy. What do you have to say to sort of these people who question the faith that people have in democracy, or the concept that democracy is always preferable to whatever else that is out there, especially in China?
You know, the authoritarianism is good camp is having a very bad time right now. I mean, because really what this is based on China's economic success. Well, China is not as economically successful as people say it is. And when the whole thing falls apart, I'm sure we're going to see that. Like we saw how the Soviet Union wasn't growing nearly as fast as we thought after it collapsed. China right now is growing at maybe 1 or 2% when we start looking at independent data. Even when we look at some of the official data, it is not consistent with 7.7% growth. That just does not occur. We're seeing things that do not occur when you have high growth that Beijing claims. But also, you know, it's not just a question of the economy. It's a question of the environment. You know, people are leaving China right now because the environment is so bad. You've got bad food, all these scandals, one right after the other. China is more corrupt than at any time in its history. And that's saying quite a lot for China. Also, you have a collapsing demography. You know, the workforce is starting to get smaller. The entire country is going to get smaller very soon because of the one-child policy, which even if one could justify it in the 1970s or 1980s, and you couldn't then, you certainly cannot do it now, because China has a very bad demography. This party has nobody else to blame. The Communist Party takes the credit for all the things that it sees that are good in Chinese society. Well, when you have a monopoly on political power, you also got to take the responsibility for things that don't go right. And when you have perhaps 200,000 protests a year, it means you have a lot of unhappy people. You know, if the Communist Party were as efficient and as good as Eric Lee and others say, then it wouldn't need to be as repressive as it is. And if it were that good, why is it becoming more repressive under Xi Jinping than it was under Hu Jintao? And it certainly was more repressive under Hu Jintao than under his predecessor, Jiang Zemin. So you put all this together and you say, well, if it's so great, why does the Communist Party need to be so coercive? Well, there is no answer. And as we're starting to see, China has reached the limit of what it can do within its political framework. And we are going to see all the symptoms of failure very soon. I actually think that at this point, China is sort of at the edge. And, you know, 6 months from now, people are going to be just laughing when they look back and see what Eric Lee has said and what he's written.
Okay, so we'll definitely come back in 6 months and come back to you again on that. But just a sort of last question, in response to these people who say democracy is not fit for Chinese culture, what do you see democracy actually look like in China in the future? Especially what would that transition look like when the PRC collapses, as you have predicted? And how has that answer changed since you first predicted that in your book in 2001, aptly named The Coming Collapse of China? So how has things stayed the same since then? How has things changed? And what does transition to democracy in China might look like to you?
Yeah, I don't know what the transition to democracy in China will look like. You know, we can look at societies around China's periphery, including Taiwan, of course, where a hardline authoritarian state to a very vibrant democracy today. You know, we see it in Hong Kong. We see people wanting more say in their lives. And clearly this is something we see in China as well, because I think that when you just scratch the surface in China, most people do not believe that a one-party system is appropriate for China's modernizing society. Now, people may not know exactly what they want, but they do know that the system that they've got isn't working. Now, how this all plays out, I don't know. You know, there could be a nice, smooth transition to democracy like everyone in the world wants to see in China, or it could be violent, chaotic, and turbulent. It could last a couple days, or it could last a couple centuries. You know, we have had periods in Chinese history where China has been grand and glorious. We've also had periods lasting centuries where it hasn't been so grand and glorious. And so we really can't rule out too much of what will occur. I mean, I, along with everyone else, wants to see representative governance in China tomorrow. And, you know, who knows? It might happen because people do want more say in their lives. The Chinese people are educated. And there are a lot of reasons to be hopeful. But at this point, you know, we just don't know. And we won't know until it actually occurs. But as I said, you look at the periphery of China, you see all these societies that are modernizing, that have become much more democratic. And that is a sign for hope.
Well, just to sum it up, we're seeing these sort of cracks on sort of Chinese hold on power in the peripheries, especially in Hong Kong, as we saw last night, and in Taiwan, as we saw earlier this year. And also you mentioned this maritime Asia alliance or cooperation between countries from Japan to Southeast Asia to India. And then we have the U.S. Playing hopefully a more active role in the region in the future. I really want to thank you again, Gordon, for sharing all that wisdom and observation with us.
Well, I don't know about wisdom, but I had a so thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Katagalan Project on Katagalan Media. This is Che Ting Ye. Find us on our website at katagalanmedia.com. That's KetaGalanMedia.com. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.